Today's episode is part one of a conversation with Giara Lagana about Northern Ireland and the European Union. Of course, Northern Ireland joined at the same time as the Republic of Ireland in 1973, along with the rest of the United Kingdom. Here, Giara talks about those early years, from accession up to the 1990s. All right, we're here in conversation with Giara Lagana, who's lecturer in politics at Cardiff University and also a Leverhulme Fellow. She is president of the Irish Association for Contemporary European Studies, and she's the author of The European Union and the Northern Ireland Peace Process, which was published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2021. Welcome, Giara.
Thank you so much here for your invite.
Now, what we're here to talk about, this podcast is about 50 years of Irish membership in the European Union and, as it was previously, the European Community. But of course, most of that is we're talking about the Republic of Ireland, but obviously Northern Ireland also joined the European Union at the same time as the Republic because it was part of a constituent part of the United Kingdom, which joined also in 1973. So, Giara, perhaps you could set the stage for this conversation by telling us what it was like in Northern Ireland in 1973 at the moment when Northern Ireland joined the European Community.
Okay, so to put a little bit everything in context, we need first from a Northern Ireland and a peace building perspective, which is probably what I can offer in particular when we talk about 50 years of Ireland membership of the European Union. And when I say Ireland, I mean the island of Ireland, just to be clear. Well, in 1973, Northern Ireland politics and Northern Ireland political actors didn't focus or didn't show any awareness that EU membership could in any way foster or help finding a resolution for a conflict that in 73 was at its highest peak. So some of the discussions and some of the attention mostly to joining the EC went on between and just marginally between and within the civil rights movement and between SDLP politicians. But as I said, there was really no awareness that any sort of solution could come from that arena. Also because I think that local politics were most pressing. And we need to think about the fact that in 1973, two main events happened in Northern Ireland. First, I would mention the Northern Ireland border poll that was held in March 73 on whether Northern Ireland should remain part of the United Kingdom or join the Republic of Ireland to form a United Ireland. This was the first time that a major referendum had been held in any region of the United Kingdom. It was unfortunately boycotted by nationalists and resulted in a conclusive victory for remaining in the UK. Curiously, the SDLP called for the boycott of the referendum to stop, as at least their leader at the time said, Gerry Fitt, to stop an escalation in violence. And also in terms of another very significant political event in Northern Ireland at the time, we need to remember the Sunningdale Agreement and also the failure of the Sunningdale Agreement. That was, again, came into force in March 73, and it was the first attempt of Northern Ireland getting a power-sharing executive. highly boycotted, as we know, by all unionist parties. And probably also what, however, started to set the scene for subsequent attempts to find a joint solution for the Northern Ireland conflict, to bring everyone around the table of the negotiations, even if at that time without a direct input of the Republic of Ireland. Why did it fail? Well, I'm no expert on it, so I don't want to say anything that any contribution that any expert could give 20 million times better. But I once interviewed the secretary of Brian Faulkner, and he was a key Northern Ireland civil servant. His name is Chris McCabe, and he was subsequently involved in any stage of the peace process of working still and very closely within the Northern Ireland office. And he said that their mistake at that time was not talking to everyone and not trying to find consent and compromise with all the parties involved in Northern Ireland, which is a lesson that he said they learned afterwards, with in particular everything that happened with the talks in the 90s.
So we're looking at so Northern Ireland joins along with the rest of the UK. Northern Ireland joins the European community as it then was in 1973, but Northern Ireland is much more focused on internal issues. It's kind of this, of the upheaval of the Troubles. The Troubles are relatively, they just started about 5 years before. And so nobody knew at the time that they were going to go on for another, well, until the 1990s. And so Northern Ireland politics is in turmoil, and there are various attempts to try and bring a power sharing agreement. That Sunningdale, and that fails. Not long after that, the Wilson government comes into office, and they decide to have a referendum on whether or not to remain in the European community. Northern Ireland votes, I believe, by a margin of 52 to 48, that they want to remain in the European community, but that is actually a lower margin than either in England, Wales, or Scotland. So you don't get the sense that that membership of the European Union is popular in Northern Ireland at the time.
I completely agree on you on this point. I'm not sure about the reasons of this, let's say, mild support for EC membership. But I think that part of it was really not getting a sense that this could in any way easing or fostering local politics, and that let's say a possible Europeanization of Northern Ireland issues could have helped for a solution. But also we need to think from the other side, from what the EEC at the time was. And I think that in many member states, it was perceived as something too remote, purely economic in its nature and not political at all, to actually made really a difference in local politics. And also that dialectic, that seeing the EEC project, the European project, as a peace building process really entered the political discourse really with John Hume. And then it became popular everywhere in the member states. But I think it was mostly John Hume. For many, it was just decisions about coal and steel and how to manage resources in order to avoid World War II to happen again, just simplifying and saying it in a very easy way. So for people that were suffering of violence, of political violence. Well, it was difficult to see how that could bring particular benefits.
Right. Okay. So, and you mentioned the name of John Hume, who's obviously a giant in this whole story. So that brings us to kind of the next major milestone, which is 1979, and for the first time, you have direct election to the European Parliament. The European Parliament at the time, of course, was still a fairly powerless body. Its powers were mainly advisory in kind of the amongst the institutions of the European Union, but it offered an opportunity for politicians to actually have a European stage where they could make a mark. And so of course, Northern Ireland elects I guess three MEPs, three members of the European Parliament, for the first time in 1979. So, and that begins a very interesting political process. You want to talk about that?
Yes, of course. As you said, you mentioned John Hume, and I think we'll hear a lot of him in this episode of this podcast, really, because he was instrumental in all the stage that involved the EC-EU into the conflict first and peace process secondly. But yeah, with the direct election, really, the European Parliament started to serve as a forum for Northern Ireland political actors in which to articulate more directly the issues that were ravaging Northern Ireland, and also a forum to seek support. The key event was the SDLP becoming part of the socialist group. A lot was because of how Europositive John Hume, not Jerry Fitt, had been. And when the secretary of the party, of the Socialist Party from the EU, went to Northern Ireland and deciding who better fit the European political group, he made a written recommendation on the SDLP instead of the Labour Party, pointing out Hume as a political figure, as someone who really was articulated in European matters, because he had served with Dick Burke that on European related issues, and also because he was fluent in French, because he originally was a teacher and a lecturer of French. So all of these actually helped the cause. And Hume joined when he was direct elected at the very forefront of the Socialist Party, acting as the treasurer. So giving him really leverage. We think that at that time, people and key political figures in Europe sat in that European party, like Helmut Kohl, François Mitterrand, and having, let's say, even just a discussion, sitting on the same ranks of these people that are actually starting to listen to you and also to join the cause for Northern Ireland helped. But at the very beginning, we need to say, and we need to point out the fact that it was mostly Irish, Republic of Ireland MEPs who helped bring in to the attention of the Parliament the Northern Ireland situations, in particular during the time of the hunger strikes, when the three Northern Ireland MEPs also visited Bobby Sands in prison, and they did so as MEPs, not as TDs. Even if this didn't prevent the Thatcher, and I'm quoting from the archives, to define them as MEPs of a foreign country, but this helped rising attention, and also it showed how, for example, using the instruments available within the European Parliament, the motion for resolutions, the European Parliament speeches, and John Hume, in an interview in particularly told me that this observation, watching how the Irish MEPs were doing, taught him a lot. And in 1981, just after Bobby Sands' death, I found the first motion for resolution signed by John Hume on purely economic matters related to Northern Ireland. And why he did kept it economic and not political, because it was easier to get Paisley and Taylor, the other two Northern Ireland MEPs, on board with him. And when the Parliament saw that actually there was not full agreement, but that the three Northern Ireland MEPs could actually present something together and endorse together the following report that was published, the Martin report published in 1981, that had the full endorsement of the three MEPs in the plenary section of the European Parliament. Well, there was also more willingness from the European Parliament to help and to get involved, keeping it, let's say, on a neutral as possible matter. But first, the European Parliament needed to do something. And again, I'm quoting from the evidence that I found and everything I studied for many years. But they needed to understand specifically the root causes of the Northern Ireland conflict before seeing where and if support could be provided to the region. And that's how the what was published as the AGRUP report, published in 83, got to be compiled. It was a call coming from the Parliament, and in particular from the socialist group, to really understand better why there was even a conflict and why was there was violence in that region. And a completely neutral MEP was sent to Northern Ireland, Ireland and the UK to undertake this inquiry, Niels Agerup, a Danish MEP, that had already taken some attention into Northern Ireland matters, and he really brought back a very interesting and neutral report, where we can almost find the exact design of what afterwards became the European strategy for peace building.
That's very, very interesting. So what you're telling me, there are kind of two strands to the story. One is economic and the other is political. It sounds that sounds like the three MEPs who represent different sides, obviously quite different, very different sides of the political spectrum in Northern Ireland. They agree, they come together and agree on in supporting a report basically looking for economic assistance to Northern Ireland. And so, but then another report, the Sagarup report, was, I imagine, not necessarily supported by all three MEPs, but it was a report of the European Parliament maybe you don't want to say Europeanize the conflict, but at least bring a European kind of dimension or European role in the Northern Ireland peace process, correct?
Yes, in the book I have defined it as an exercise of historicization to look at how articulate within the local context a role for the European Union, EEC as it was at that time, that would not go against UK politics, so that would not, let's say, make the UK establishment unsupportive of anything of anything undertaken, of any steps undertaken. And curiously, while the UK was really against the report when it and against the inquiry, and while the government, the UK government, instructed everyone in the Northern Ireland office and in Northern Ireland, within Northern Ireland political parties, etc., not to cooperate with Agrup, Baroness Lady Ellis had a private conversation with a civil servant that I cannot name in the Northern Ireland office, saying, listen, this Agrup is a sensible guy, he's a sensitive guy. Just talk to him, speak to him. And Baroness Lady Ellis was at that time an MEP for the UK within the European Parliament. And so Agrup received a lot of documentation from the Northern Ireland office through the UK embassy in Copenhagen. And yes, the outcome of the report at the end was received very positive within the UK government. Archival evidence really shows that they were happy with the results and with the summary that Agrup had made of the situation, mostly because I think, let's say, all the blame was put on the unionist community and not on the British government, on the unionist community not understanding that direct rule was supposed to be a temporary provision and not a definitive one, which is actually in line with what Jennifer Todd has often argued and wrote about.
Right. And so let's talk a bit about the other quite famous MEP, and that is Ian Paisley. So you have John Hume of the SDLP, who represents, you know, he comes from the nationalist community. And then you, on the other side, you have Ian Paisley, who from the Democratic Unionist Party, who represents kind of quite extreme, well, I don't want to, maybe I shouldn't use the word extreme, but well, very, very kind of forceful unionist views, but also very quite startling, like anti-European views, and to the point where at some points he kind of talks about the European Union as kind of like the Antichrist, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And so obviously Reverend Ian Paisley, he's a religious man, he's a man who started his own church within Northern Ireland. So he's very much kind of basically a fundamentalist Protestant Christian. And he has a lot of problems with the European Union, and at one point denounced the Pope Pope John Paul II spoke to the European Parliament. So, well, I'll ask you to say a few words about Paisley and ask maybe how he and John Hume got along with each other from opposite sides of the political spectrum.
Absolutely. Now, surprisingly, all the evidence I found and all the people I spoke to, and there are many of them, I can say, they all spoke about Paisley in Europe very positively, very focusing on the good that could be brought back to Northern Ireland from engaging with the European Union, EEC as it was, or even supporting some of the speeches or initiatives that Hume proposed, without, and this needs also to be highlighted, without failing to mention all the time that everyone in the parliament was aware that the two had their differences locally. But I could quote a number of instances where they actually joined, where they actually worked together. And since I have already spoken a little bit about the past, but in the occasion of the publication of the Martin Report in 1981, they both in the plenary denounced the lack of additionality of European funds for Northern Ireland. I'm sure you are much more familiar than me also with the topic of additionality, but additionality means that all the money coming from the European Union needs to be additional to the UK expenditure in Northern Ireland. And a lack of additionality means that the money coming from the European Union goes first to Westminster or to the Treasury, and that would cut its own expenditure, substituting it with EU money, which meant that sometimes Northern Ireland would not receive the totality of the EU expenditure, or at least of the whole expenditure that it was entitled to. And Paisley really joined Hume denouncing this quote, and I'm quoting here because I remember that this is a fraud from the UK government to Northern Ireland. And I can almost imagine Paisley with its verb saying it to the European Parliament. And another occasion in which they absolutely work together, it's much later in the 90s, after the declaration of the paramilitary ceasefires, where the three Northern Ireland MEPs in the 90s, it was Jim Nicholson then joining Paisley and Hume. Jim Nicholson joined as an MEP much earlier than the 90s, but he was working with them to go and see in the lawyers and saying, we can do more for Northern Ireland now that at least violence is off. And yes, it contrasts a bit with what was the general local image of Paisley. And again, I'm quoting, I think it was a journal article where he said, I'm going to get everything I can for Northern Ireland, every single penny, and when we have milked the cow dry, we are going to shoot the cow. Which, by the way, doesn't mean that you become a Euro-supportive and a Euro-positivist or whatever. It just means that you are going to try and get and work for the good of Northern Ireland to bring back as much money as you can. If the result is then providing civil society with more means to rebuild the environment, to rebuild the political life and the quotidianity of the people of Northern Ireland after so many years of violence and conflict, what's wrong with that?
So it's fair, I think it's fair to say that Paisley, he had a transactional view of the relationship between Northern Ireland and the European Union. The Democratic Unionists were pretty consistently a Eurosceptic party. And the SDLP was pretty pro-European all the way through. At a certain point, the SDLP is kind of the SDLP seat in the European Parliament is replaced by Sinn Féin. And Sinn Féin, I think, on paper at least, is a more Eurosceptic party than the SDLP, though they've modified their position over the years. What was the role of Sinn Féin, the Sinn Féin MEP in the parliament?
Okay, when I tried when I spoke with the Sinn Féin representatives in order to understand their political positioning towards the European Union, what they have almost unanimously say is that they are critically engaging with European Union matters. When I asked for the definitions of critically engaging, nobody was able to give me the same. So I would just say that for my experience, for what I could see, always in relations to the peace process and the European Union, there wasn't the same level of positive engagement that Hume had. But this is not just for Sinn Féin. This is for all political parties represented in the European Parliament from Northern Ireland and probably also from many other member states, I would say. But Sinn Féin has nonetheless worked closely in terms of all the bottom-up analysis done in every single stage of the peace programs preparations. So for peace 2, peace 3, peace 4, they were very cooperative on that side and very supportive of also fighting to receive this money that could keep alive the bottom-up peace process that was going on in the region. And this is really important. But that said, it is true also for Unionist Party. And they have become, of course, a lot more active in showing their support for the European Union since the Brexit referendum results. So with Martina Anderson in particular, constantly being on the forefront for anything that was related to Brexit and in particular to not supporting Brexit.
You've been listening to Decades, made with the support of the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative, although the views of the guests are entirely their own. The Post-Brexit Europe podcast is a product of the DCU Brexit Institute. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano. Thank you for listening.